I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Our conversation today is about Hillary Clinton. How did a youth minister and a conservative Senate prayer breakfast shape the woman who wants to be president? But first, Florida officials say a simple cutoff switch may have caused yesterday's 300-mile-wide blackout and shutdown of two nuclear power plants. That outage is shining a light once again on the country's power infrastructure, which a Colorado engineering professor called the most complex machine in the world, but critics say doesn't measure up to the rest of the developing world. Rhonda Victor is senior anchor for WLRN Miami Herald Radio News. Rhonda, we understand this problem started with a small fire in a substation. Is that when this cutoff switch failed?
That's what we're hearing, is that a switch that should have contained that failed to go off, and instead other switches that, or other, like a circuit breaker that sensed the power, did in fact go off, and that sent shockwaves, in literally speaking, to other substations and kind of got the ball rolling.
For want of a switch, we understand it's a huge switch, maybe 10 feet long, but
yes.
Do we understand why that safety switch didn't throw?
No, we don't. That's one of the things that Florida Power and Light is looking into, and that's the question everybody is asking today. Florida Power and Light officials said this morning they may not know the answer for days or possibly even weeks.
Explain the grid system there in Florida, by the way, and many other parts of the country also are on the grid. How does that factor into this?
The best that I understand it is that the entire electrical system in the country is interconnected, so that if something happens in a small substation like this one, others will come in and take up the slack, and we shouldn't notice it. What Florida Power and Light has, and has agreements with other electric utilities, both in Florida and around the nation, is that they are all somewhat interconnected. And when there's a sneeze in Miami, it's felt in Daytona Beach.
Right. Well, other countries are switching to smart grids, which are less centralized and have a bigger diversity of these power, makers, if you will, providers. We read in the Miami Herald that Jay Apt, an electrical reliability expert at Carnegie Mellon University, says the rest of the world does better. On average, U.S. customers lose power for 214 minutes, but in other countries it may be 53 minutes in France, 6 in Japan. What are some of the other bigger questions being asked today about American power?
I can tell you that for Florida Power and Light, the biggest pressure that utility has come under is how hard and how hurricane-ready its equipment is. That's been the biggest issue for us in South Florida. 2.5 years ago, we were hit by what was a relatively minor Category 1, Category 2 hurricane. There were many people who did not have electricity for as long as 2 weeks. So the utility came under extreme fire for that and has been focusing its efforts on what we call hardening its infrastructure, making sure that the poles that hold the power lines are not rotted wood, as many were, and so there may be poured concrete, making sure that the substations are not surrounded by trees, making sure that lines aren't as fallible. So really, that's what the focus has been on for Florida Power and Light, and this incident that occurred yesterday is obviously going to direct attention away from preparing for hurricanes.
Just a note, I happened to be in Florida yesterday in another part of the state, and I was watching on television while television reporters were saying, we're trying to alert people in this area of a tornado, but we're aware they can't see us because there's a power outage.
So, and when I had first heard of the power outage, because I was not personally affected by it, I live in the suburban areas of western Miami-Dade County, when I first heard that it was statewide, I assumed it was from the bad weather that was in the northern part of the
right.
state.
Well, remember other blackouts in 2003, one stretched from Ohio to New York, that was blamed on human error. Is there any discussion of switching to some other forms of energy as backup for these electrical grids?
Well, Florida Power and Light, in fact, is exploring many options. There are two nuclear power plants in the southern portion of Miami-Dade County, which were automatically shut down yesterday, and FPNL has two other nuclear power plants in Florida and is seeking to add to the Turkey Point facility in South Dade two reactors over the next 10 to 15 years. FPNL is also looking into solar energy and will have an experimental substation set up by, I believe, the year 2010. And in fact, ironically, yesterday, the state gave FPNL a $2.5 million grant to invest in wind energy. So yes, we certainly are looking at it, but I don't think for any time there's going to be any kind of substitute for the coal, natural gas, and nuclear power, which is the source of most of Florida's energy.
Rhonda Victor, senior anchor for WLRN Miami Herald Radio, speaking to us from Miami. Rhonda, thank you.
Thank you.
Before last night's Democratic presidential debate, a Hillary Clinton supporter speaking on MSNBC said she should just be herself, to which reporter David Gregory responded, "Which self?" Hillary Clinton is perhaps the most familiar of the candidates in that Americans have watched her evolve from first lady to senator, from presidential frontrunner to combative underdog. In our final segment on the major presidential candidates, a closer look at Clinton, an Illinois-born Methodist and Republican, a self-described Goldwater girl turned college Democratic activist drawn more to wonky meetings than to marches. Michael Tomasky is American editor of The Guardian. He's a contributor to the New York Review of Books and author of Hillary's Turn, Inside Her Improbable Victorious Senate Campaign. And Michael joins us now. Welcome.
My pleasure, Robin.
And since you've followed a Hillary Clinton campaign so closely, what jumped out at you from last night's debate?
She came across to me as very frustrated. She's having a hard time scoring big points against Obama. And I think the general consensus on the debate is that it was kind of a draw, or maybe he came away with a slight advantage. I see no reason to depart from that general consensus. He's really improved. She's always been good at this, but he's really improved. So she had a tougher time connecting.
Well, she said last night, and a New York Times fact check agrees, that she's asked more first questions and more questions overall than her competitor. Do you agree? And if so, is this one of her stories, almost, that she's maybe punished in some way for her wonkiness?
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's for her wonkiness. Her people are now making a lot of noise about this media bias against her. I think they're overplaying it personally, but I do think that to some extent it's true. There are long, long, deep-seated reasons for it that I think were set into train, really, back in 1992 and 93 when she first came on the national scene and arrived in Washington as First Lady, and was at that point in her life very suspicious of the press. And once those first impressions congeal, it's very hard to undo them. I guess if the numbers say that it's true that she's asked more first questions, then obviously it's true. That can be an advantage because you get more airtime.
But it can be a disadvantage if you think that your competitor is just listening to your answers and then expanding on them when his turn comes. Well, let's take a look at some of the issues. Health care, her plan would mandate it for all Americans. Obama has said he's against mandates except for children. The Iraq War, she would draw down troops but not set a date. NAFTA. There have been such sharp exchanges over this issue. Let's just pause there. Where does she stand on NAFTA?
My memory is that she's always been pro-NAFTA, and you know, her people are now saying that inside the Clinton White House, she was arguing against NAFTA, or at least for trade and environmental codicils to be attached to it. That may be so. I don't necessarily remember it. What I do remember quite specifically is an episode from the summer of 2000 when I was covering her first Senate campaign, and we were on her bus with her going from, I think, Buffalo to Niagara Falls, or driving around Niagara Falls, New York. And there were a lot of signs up there of shuttered plants and jobs having left upstate New York. And I asked her whether she would, you know, having seen upstate New York now for some number of months, whether she would allow that, you know, maybe NAFTA did have some negative impact. And she said yes. And I'm pretty sure that that was the first time she publicly said anything negative about NAFTA. So my memory is that her record during her husband's tenure was pretty strongly in favor of the agreement.
Well, she's saying now that she could be the kind of fighter who could renegotiate NAFTA, who could hold feet to the fire. And that's part of another theme that we've been hearing from Hillary Clinton, that she's a fighter, that the country deserves a fighter. How much of her background feeds into that authentically? Much has been made of her dad, Hugh, an authoritarian. Tell us a little more about that.
Yeah, he was an authoritarian, I would say, from things I've read, bordering on sadist, who was very stern. I don't want to get into pop psychology here, but obviously the way she was raised had something to do with the way she approaches issues, the way she presents herself in public, and the way she projects strength and won't project vulnerability and so forth. I think there's probably some connection there.
Well, and we wonder, too, much has been made about Barack Obama's mother. What about Hillary Clinton's mother? She's been out on the campaign trail with her. Is there something to look at there? Or?
I think her mother was a very quiet role model for her, someone who, her father was a very conservative Republican, very staunchly and loudly so. Her mother was somewhat more quietly, a little bit more liberal. I think her mother taught her that she could go her own way, but that she should do so somewhat carefully, which all, I guess, makes sense with the way we've seen her comport herself over the last 15 years.
Well, you and others write that there was another important figure in her young life. It was in her church. The youth minister in her Methodist church took her to see Martin Luther King speak. And, sort of a transformative moment.
It was. The man's name was Don Jones. They're still friends. It was a very typical story of a young white girl in the 1950s who grew up in a wealthy suburb and had not seen firsthand what life was like for people outside of a circumstance like hers until Don Jones took her to see that. And it did change her view of the world. And then, of course, going off to Wellesley, which she was still a Republican for her first, I think, for her freshman and sophomore year. Was still a Republican, but then, that finally got her.
At Wellesley, she delivered the first student commencement address, along with a commencement from the then-sitting Massachusetts Senator Edward Brooke. Took him to task in her address, criticizing him for comments on the Vietnam War. So, as you said, the transformation was complete. And that brings us to her meeting Bill Clinton at Yale, her marriage, and the track, as we know it, that took them to Arkansas. And here it seems as if biographers of Hillary Clinton feel the need to understand her motivation in marrying Bill Clinton, in staying with him after his personal blunders, in her running for president. The question is always, what's behind it? Is it a power grab or public service? A question that we don't feel maybe is asked other people, why they are running for office or marrying someone. Is that a fair analysis, or do you think she's just questioned the way others are? And in any event, do you think it's an answer we can find, what her motivation is?
I think that she is subject to more of that kind of speculation than most people are, and I think some of it is unfair. Some of it is probably fair to the extent that she is sort of opaque, and she doesn't seem to speak from her heart that much. She doesn't seem to say that much about what's inside her deeply and emotionally. She keeps all that very covered. So that, if you will, creates a little bit of a vacuum that makes people speculate. But, my own view, and I know her a little bit, and I know a lot of the people who work for her, I don't really subscribe to the deeply cynical, she's just madly ambitious interpretation of her life. I think that one can have ambition only for oneself, or one can have ambitions that are tied to larger other ideas. And I do think, call me naive, but I do think that her ambition is the latter kind, and that she does have a very serious idea of and commitment for public service.
Michael Tomasky is author of Hillary's Turn, Inside the Improbable Victorious Senate Campaign. When we come back, Clinton has criticized Obama's record, what is hers in the Senate, and also behind the scenes, why her arch enemies, Senator Sam Brownback and others, apologized to Hillary Clinton for their unchristian attitude towards her. That's next. Later today, Leaplings. Friday's their big day. Back in a minute, Here and Now. We're back with Michael Tomasky, author of Hillary's Turn, Inside the Improbable Victorious Senate Campaign, with our look at Hillary Clinton. And Michael, I want to go back to last night's debate. Barack Obama said in response to Hillary Clinton's claim that the country needs a fighter and she would be that fighter. He said she fought with her own party when she was first lady, pushing her health care reform that ultimately failed. Is that true? And if so, how do you square that with her reputation as a senator? Joshua Green writes in The Atlantic that she dominates by yielding. So what about Barack Obama's comment?
That was the sharpest jab that I thought Obama threw last night. It was the only moment that really made me sit up in my chair and go, whoa, I was surprised to hear it. It is true, as far as we know. Pat Moynihan and others in the Democratic Party felt shut out of the deliberations on the health care planning and strategizing that she led. And it reflects a larger thing, which is really her theory of change stems from her background, her experiences of the 1990s when You know, she was attacked quite frequently and often quite unfairly.
Well, but then on the flip side, explain the, you know, dominating by yielding in the Senate. Joshua Green also writes about a meeting called the Fellowship. It's a secretive prayer group that's been there for decades, been attended by conservatives like Sam Brownback and Rick Santorum. Clinton joined in 2001. When I say secretive, it's just very private. It's not, you know, not made public, except apparently some stories have leaked out about how Hillary Clinton joining this group has been remarkably transformational for the conservative men in the group.
It has, and I think she disarmed a lot of people by joining this group and by being the kind of senator that she was. You know, a lot of people thought that she would try to be, you know, some kind of glamour puss and hogging the headlines, but she wasn't that, and I knew she wouldn't be that. That's not her nature. That's not her way. Her way is more quiet and methodical and diligent, and that's indeed what she's done, and she has endeared herself to a lot of her conservatives now, colleagues. Now, interestingly, I think there are ways in which she, you know, gets along in some respects with the Republicans better than with her fellow Democrats, where there's more competition.
I just want to have added to that within this prayer meeting, several people who had been her arch enemies actually got up in what were apparently powerful moments and apologized to her.
They did. Some who worked on her husband's impeachment have become friends of hers, Lindsey Graham, most notably, in South Carolina. And one thing that has always struck me is that on September 11th and in the immediate aftermath of the attacks, her staff were overwhelmed and overworked and tired and needed to go home and get sleep. And they were helped by the staff of Alabama Republican Senator Jefferson Sessions, who really is one of the most right-wing members of the Senate, but who sent his staff up to her office to help them out and help answer their phones and bring them sandwiches and so forth. And I've always been struck in my mind by that image of very, very conservative Alabamans picking up a phone and saying, Senator Hillary Clinton's office.
What is going to be her legacy from the Senate? Here's, first of all, what she put forth last night of some of her foreign policy experience.
You know, helping to support the peace process in Northern Ireland, negotiating to open borders so that refugees fleeing ethnic cleansing would be safe, going to Beijing and standing up for women's rights as human rights and so much else.
Michael Tomasky, is there so much else?
I think that she's been a very effective home state senator, very popular in New York and in very Republican regions of New York, and has done or tried to do a lot for her state. As a legislative senator, she's no Ted Kennedy, but then again, not that many people are.
How about the baggage of the Clinton administration? Impeachment, Whitewater scandal? Barack Obama hasn't brought them up. Will the Republicans?
The Republicans will, sure. And the Republicans, in fact, if she is the nominee, might overplay their hand with regard to those things. That said, it could still be an electoral liability, and that is a very serious concern of many Democrats.
Well, what do you think happens now? If Hillary Clinton does get the nomination from her party, in what ways do you see her changing because of the rough run that's behind her? If she doesn't get the nomination of her party, where do you see her going from there?
Well, if she does get the nomination, which I have to say seems quite unlikely to me, but if she does get it, the first job is to smooth the ruffled feathers, not only with Barack Obama himself, but with his constituencies, who are vast. And, you know, he's gotten about 1 million more votes than she has. So if she happens to win this thing, she has to really, really work hard to get those people back on her side, because they're going to be pretty hard feelings. So that'll be job number one. If she's not the nominee, Obama will have, you know, his version of that job to reach out to her and to her supporters, who also feel very strongly in her defense. But she then will have to do something that will be, I would imagine, pretty tough for her and her husband, which is that they'll have to accept that they lost, and they'll have to be gracious about it, and they'll have to go to the convention, and they'll have to give speeches, and they'll have to talk to people about why they need to vote for Barack Obama. It's not going to be easy for her, but it's something that she's going to have to do. Then moving beyond this year, and she has a tremendous opportunity to be a, you know, what we call a gray hair, right? A terrific three or four or five term senator who can have a because of her stature and the respect she has gained from her colleagues, who can have a tremendous Senate career. That's not the worst thing in the world.
Michael Tomasky, American editor of The Guardian and contributor to the New York Review of Books, author of Hillary's Turn, Inside Her Improbable Victorious Senate Campaign. Michael, it's a great title. Clinton supporters are probably hoping you have another book in you.
I cannot speculate on the future, as Hillary herself might say.
Right. Michael, thanks very much.
I really enjoyed it, Robin. Thanks.
And tomorrow on Here and Now, he was known for Moon River, but singer-songwriter Johnny Mercer had a darker side. We'll deconstruct drinking again, from Frank Sinatra to Rod Stewart. Still ahead today, J.K. Rowling versus a former librarian in a copyright suit. Is he stealing her stuff? That's after the news, Here and Now. Harry Potter creator J.K. Rowling is doing battle again, not in a book against an evil sorcerer, but in a U.S. courtroom against a former school librarian. Rowling is suing to prevent a small publishing house in Michigan from printing and selling a book edition of the Harry Potter Lexicon. That's a website for fans of all things Harry. It's run by that former school librarian, Stephen van der Ark. This is the latest chapter in a long-running saga pitting copyright holders against fair use advocates. Joining us to explain what's at stake, Joe Nocera, who writes about the world of business for the New York Times. And Joe, in welcoming you, we should say you've also been writing in favor of the librarian. You have a point of view on this.
Oh, absolutely. You know, one of my core beliefs is that fair use has been not denied exactly, but, you know, made more and more difficult as copyright holders have gotten more and more aggressive about what their rights are. And the courts have gone back and forth on this, and one of the reasons that this case is important is that if J.K. Rowling wins, it really makes it very, very difficult for people to use fair use the way I think it was originally intended.
Well, let's get some definitions out of the way. What is fair use?
Fair use is the right to use the copyrighted work of somebody else, and so there are always limits to that. You can't make a movie out of a Harry Potter book and call it fair use. That's called a derivative work. And that all makes total sense.
For instance, you point out there are companion books to the Narnia Chronicles or
that's
the works
right.
of Tolkien.
That's
fair use.
And right. And there are companion books, I might add, to Harry Potter at this point, too, that J.K. Rowling has kind of signed off on, for lack of a better word. The issue is, how much control does she really have over the use of Harry Potter? And the answer is that if somebody else makes a work that is about Harry Potter but isn't a ripoff, isn't complete plagiarism, isn't simply a listing of Harry Potter words and definitions, but is a unique addition using Harry Potter as a springboard to another piece of art or another work, that is legal. And that's really, or I think it's legal, we're going to find out.
Right.
And that's really what this case is about.
Well, help us understand that. Tell us about Stephen van der Ark's website. It's a place where he's just compiled all sorts of information about Harry Potter. In fact, Rowling even praised the site in the past. She said it was
right.
a website for the dangerously obsessive, my natural home. So he now wants to take that and put it in some sort of encyclopedia, a lexicon
form. That's exactly right. I mean, one of the weird things about this case is that something that she has signed off on the website, she's basically saying they can't do in a book version.
Well, but let's express some of her thoughts, because, first of all, the website he wasn't making money from, correct? And the
right.
book he would, and I think that's one of her objections.
Well, it is, but that's not a legal distinction. I mean, she makes several arguments. One is that she wants to do her own encyclopedia eventually, and this would affect her ability to do so, which of course is baloney.
Well, I was just hold on a second, because you don't have a lot of sympathy with her on that point. And we were thinking in the office, because she said that she does eventually want to do her own encyclopedia and have the whatever profit comes from that go to charity. Doesn't she have that right to have, you know, have her own project with her own work?
Absolutely. And nobody's saying she can't do it, and nobody's saying she can't give the money to charity. I mean, I think there's something incredibly self-righteous on her part in saying, hey, I want to give the money for this to charity, therefore nobody else can do something similar to this, even if it's legal, because I'm so good-hearted, I want to give the money to charity. And they make a big, big, big deal about that in her office and among her representatives. And I think it's just total baloney. My columns are posted on the web by people in violation of copyright every single week. It's the world, it's life, it's the world we live in.
What if someone took your columns and put them in a book and sold it as the compilation of columns of Joe Nocera?
Well, that's a derivative work. That's not allowed.
Ah.
I mean, that you cannot do. If you step back from all the emotional issues, and there are emotional issues here because J.K. Rowling did invent these characters. There's no question. But copyright isn't meant to freeze something forever, and copyright isn't meant to stifle other people's creativity. And what this case is about is whether, I mean, it's really, it comes down to something really simple. Is the Harry Potter Encyclopedia a quote-unquote derivative work, i.e., it borrows so heavily from J.K. Rowling and just kind of reprints as opposed to repurposes? Or is it something that adds something unique and original that is therefore allowed under copyright law?
Well, in the meantime, you know, you talk about how copyright laws have been, you know, stiffened, that copyright copyrights have been extended. You remind us that they used to last for 14 years, a century ago. Then there was an extension. Today, Congress has passed laws that say that copyrights last 95 years for corporations. For individuals, it's 70 years after their deaths.
Right.
Do you see, especially with all the other battles that are ongoing, we see the writer's strike, writers angry that their work is going to be reproduced on the Internet, fights over what can get posted on YouTube. Are copyright laws going to be sort of blurred with the other new world, which is works being taken and put on new media?
Yes, it's happening all the time. I mean, it's really, copyright is basically under assault. You've got two conflicting forces in play here. The first is the desire, primarily driven by corporations, but also by wealthy authors and copyright holders, to extend copyright as long as possible. I mean, copyright used to be like patent law, which is, you know, you give a company protection for a short time to give them incentive to create, and then it's open to everybody. You know, when you think about pharmaceuticals, right, you know, the patent lasts like 20 years,
right,
and then it goes into a generic form, and nobody complains about that. Nobody says that Lipitor ought to stay patented forever. You know, the patent has a limited use. Copyright used to have a limited use. Copyright used to be something that's like, okay, let's give somebody an incentive to create, and then after a while, after a fairly short time, it passes into the public domain, and anybody can use it, or anybody can reprint it. So one force at play is, you know, copyright holders wanting to extend and control copyright. A lot of the kind of old media trying to wrestle with the Internet is about that. And then on the flip side, you have the Internet and the ability it gives people to use copyrighted material in a public way is unprecedented. And you can't stop all of that. It's as if a dam has burst. And so, you know, you have this giant collision, and it's hard to know how it will end, except that, you know, in the end, most of the time, technology usually trumps the efforts of old-fashioned laws to rein it in.
Well, we'll see how it ends. J.K. Rowling, of course, going to try to stop an Internet sensation, which was the Lexicon website, from becoming a book. Joe Nocera writes about the world of business for The New York Times. Joe, thanks for your time today. We'll check back in to see how this court case goes.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate being here.
And where do you fall in the argument over who owns what? We want to hear from you. Send us your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org, letters@here-now.org. Here's a note about some of the stories we're working on. Montana's Democratic Governor Brian Schweitzer is at the forefront of a movement to develop clean coal technology. We'll ask him about that. Also, poverty as a campaign issue. Not. Why didn't more candidates talk about the poor? And before we go today, Mr. Jeopardy, we don't mean Alex Trebek. You're listening to Here and Now. Did you know there are 4 million leaplings in the world today? These are people born on February 29th during a leap year. They'll be celebrating this Friday. But why do we have leap years? Where do they come from? Well, with the help of an astronomer, a science whiz, an ancient Alexandrian with an unpronounceable name, and a mother of five, producer Rebecca Shear in Juneau, Alaska, explains.
Patty Zylstra was born in Alaska, though her family moved away when she was a toddler. Now she's a mother of five. So if someone were to ask you your age, how would you answer?
I'm going to be 12. Next birthday, I'll be a teenager. I'll probably be a menopausal teenager. And won't my kids be having fun then?
See, Patty Zylstra is a leapling.
I was born in Anchorage on February 29th, 1960.
And she's in a pretty exclusive club. The Honor Society of Leap Year Day Babies reports that for every million people, only 684 were born on February 29th. But why can Patty tell people she's a preteen and technically get away with it? I mean, why do we have these crazy leap years anyway? To find out, I paid a visit to this guy.
My name is Travis Trechter. I'm a professor at the University of Alaska Anchorage in the Physics and Astronomy Department.
And what he told me is that in Babylonian times, people used lunar calendars. They told the day by looking at the moon.
And the moon completes a full cycle of phases every 29 and a half days. Calendars, based upon the phases of the moon, use that as the way to measure what month it is. And if you think about the word month, it's based upon moon.
Indeed, the Proto-Germanic manoth, or month, comes from manon, or moon, for all you etymology junkies out there.
So many calendars, what they'd have is months that had either 29 days and then alternating months with 30 days. However, this would fall out of sync with the seasons rather quickly.
Which is why in 45 BC, Julius Caesar decided to invent a new calendar. So he imported an astronomer from Alexandria. This is the astronomer, Sisigenes? Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, that would be my guess. And nobody's going to call you wrong. Nobody knows.
That's the reassuring voice of science writer Ned Rozelle. He says that Caesar's astronomer knew that it takes the Earth a specific length of time,
365 days, 5 hours, 48 minutes, and 46 seconds,
to orbit the sun. So he rounded it off and designated each calendar year as 365 and a quarter days,
with one leap day added every 4 years.
But even then, things weren't perfect. The Julian year was still 11 minutes, 14 seconds longer than the Earth's actual journey around the sun. But since the calendar only fell out of sync by one day every 128 years, people just let it go. Until 1582, that is, when Pope Gregory XII noticed something about the spring equinox. Instead of falling on March 21st, as it usually did, it fell on the 11th.
So, to fix that, the Pope just erased 10 days from the calendar. He was doing it to sync up the calendar, so he was fighting the good fight there.
But the Pope did more than just toss October 5th through the 14th out the window. He made some rules.
You have a leap year every 4 years, except for years divided by 100.
Again, Travis Rector.
For example, in 1800 and 1900, we did not have leap years. But in 2000, we did, because there's an additional rule saying that if it's a year divisible by 400, then you will have a leap year.
That's a lot of rules.
It is a lot of rules, but those are what are necessary to keep our daily calendar in sync with the seasons.
Something else about leap year. Many countries were hesitant to ditch the Julian calendar since they feared their citizens would freak out about losing those 10 days. England and its American colonies didn't go Gregorian until 1752, and Russia held out till 1918. So when the U.S. purchased Alaska in 1867, folks living up here kind of had to fast forward a week and a half. On the bright side, though, Alaskans do get a leap year bonus, an early summer solstice. This June will tilt nearest the sun at about 4 p.m. on the 20th instead of the usual 21st. And for our leapling Patty Zylstra, it gets even better.
Yes, my family's had surprise parties for me, which really don't end up being all that much of a surprise. But on the non-birthday years, it's always my dad as the child. He'd say, this isn't your birthday. You don't get any presents. And I'd cry. And then he'd bring out the cake and ice cream and tell me when I'm 80, I can tell people I'm 20.
By the way, Patty hasn't returned to Alaska since her family moved, but she hopes to visit soon, either for her 25th wedding anniversary or her 13th birthday.
Producer Rebecca Shear in Juneau, Alaska. Coming up, the answer is this man holds the longest winning streak in the history of the game show Jeopardy. The question is, why? Why does he know this stuff here and now? I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
23,600, 75,000, a new one-day record, and now a total of $1,321,660. Will it never end for this talented young man?
Well, it finally did. That's Alex Trebek right after Ken Jennings won his 38th straight game on Jeopardy and broke the show's previous record for the most money ever earned in one game. Ken went on to win 74 straight games, still the longest winning streak in Jeopardy history, walked away with more than $2.5 million in earnings. Now he's published a new book, Ken Jennings Trivia Almanac, 8,888 questions in 365 days, and he joins us in the studio with more. Welcome.
Thanks, Robin. Thanks for having me.
And as we said, it did end. Let's just let listeners think for a second about your losing question. Somebody spilled the beans. I already know the answer. But what was the answer to the question that you lost on?
The clue was something like, most of this company, 70,000, the seasonal white-collar employees only work a few months out of the year. I had no idea. I thought it must be something over the Christmas season, maybe.
I was thinking surfing.
Yeah, something summer. You only have 30 seconds to think. You got that annoying music, pinging away in your head. And
in fact, let's hear it now.
I said FedEx, but I was pretty sure I was wrong, and I heard the woman next to me scratching away with her pen, and I knew she knew it. And sure enough, what is H&R Block is the right answer.
See? Because it's the tax,
business.
Season
thing.
That's right.
That's what I get for always doing my own taxes, I guess.
So that was the question that you lost on, but then your life started because, first of all, what did H&R Block offer you?
H&R Block offered me, financial services for life. So if you're going to lose on Jeopardy, lose on the corporate question. If the answer is, who is Benjamin Harrison, you're not seeing a cent.
But. Well, and now you're a superstar. Videos of your moments on Jeopardy are all over YouTube. Now, one would think that with all of those accomplishments, people would want to examine your strategy in answering questions about, tribes and foreign countries or something. But no, here is the most downloaded of your moments on Jeopardy.
This term for a long-handled gardening tool can also mean an immoral pleasure seeker. Ken.
What's a hoe?
No. Whoa. 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 They teach you that in school in Utah, huh?
The right answer, of course, is, do you know this?
Rake.
What is a rake? Yes. The guy who answered it right was like a Lutheran minister. And during the break, he said, I'm so glad you said ho, because that's what I was going to say. And my congregation never would have forgiven me.
And here you are, a nice Mormon boy from Utah, and everybody at home going, how does he know that word?
Apparently, ho is spelled differently in the two senses. I think that's why I was not given credit. I'm still a little angry.
Because you could contest that.
Sure. I think the Jeopardy judge has sort of hosed me there.
Well, let me talk about your new book. What was your thinking in putting it together?
It's a trivia almanac. It's got questions for every day of the year. On my website, I was and am doing a weekly trivia quiz. Every Tuesday morning, I mail out 7 questions to a few thousand subscribers. And people seem to like to have that little trivia hit right at the start of the day, right before the workday starts. And I thought, what if instead of just doing this once a week, what if people could have that little morning trivia hit for every day of the year?
Well, let's give examples. One of my favorite, we find out Dr. Seuss coined the word nerd.
That's true.
What are some of your other favorites?
One of my very favorite trivia facts, just because it has no application to life whatsoever, is that koala bears and humans have identical fingerprints. obviously this is never going to come up in real life unless you're a koala master criminal or master criminal looking to frame a koala, I guess. But that's just what's so beautiful about it, just the uselessness of it. And it reminds you that the world is a strange and wonderful place.
Has this always been a passion of yours, trivia?
Yeah, it is. It is sort of a hardwired compulsion. People seem to come out of the box that way. Trivia people. Some people are just sponges for that kind of information. And you see them when they're kids. They're the ones carrying around the Guinness Book of World Records and always annoying their parents.
That was you?
That was exactly me. I went in the closet later in life. You realize sometime around puberty that it's not a hit with girls to know Captain Kirk's middle name, but Jeopardy did finally out me, and I'm happy about that. I'm happy to embrace my inner nerd.
Well, what would you say, though, to kids now? You have children of your own. Is this stuff really worth knowing? Let me find another little factoid. History's shortest war was 1896's Anglo-Zanzibar War. It began at 9 a.m. The Sultan of Zanzibar surrendered at 9:45. Does that help me to know that?
I think it does. There's a couple things. I mean, one is that trivia, the kind of facts that are unusual and interesting like that, make learning seem fun, whether or not it's true. You know, that's the kind of thing that's going to get a kid interested in history who maybe isn't already. Mm-hmm. It's also just general knowledge. You know, it's cultural literacy. It's just because it's called trivia, it doesn't have to be trivial. It's stuff about the world around us. It makes us a more informed citizen, a better conversationalist, more annoying at parties, maybe.
I want to also touch on Bloggate. Apparently, you wrote on your blog things about the sainted Alex Trebek, host of Jeopardy, that were construed as, well, making fun of him. That, let's see, nobody knows he died in a fiery truck crash a few years back and was immediately replaced with the Trebektron 4000. He's like the Dorian Gray of syndication. Were you misunderstood, Ken Jennings?
This was, it was a sort of a satiric list of things Jeopardy could do to pep up their format. But yeah, the New York Post quoted it out of context to make it look like I was bagging on Alex, which I would never do. I'm a huge fan.
Why? Well, tell us about him. I mean, you got to see him when the cameras were off.
He was long my favorite game show. You know, just my idea of what a host should be, you know, very dignified and always putting the game ahead of his own, you know, personality. A lot of people think he's stiff or pompous just because he's, a little bit dry and dignified on the air. But in person, you can see the real Alex, and he's loosey-goosey, making jokes, doing little accents and bits of soft shoe, and he enjoys the Will Ferrell parodies of himself, for example.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's back to the book. Do you have a favorite category from your book that you can quiz us on, us being others listening, because I really am bad at this? So give me a category.
Here's something from March 5th. This honors the 1998 Hong Kong release of the movie As Good As It Gets, because in Cantonese, that movie was retitled Mr. Cat Poop.
I knew that.
And I'm not really sure why, but so here are some other questions about English language movies that got eccentric titles when they were released overseas. For example, what 1993 movie was called Monday the Whole Week in Sweden?
Ding, ding. Yes. Groundhog Day?
Correct.
Ah!
Very nice. You are one for one.
Okay.
How about a 1975 movie in Germany? It was called The Knights of the Coconut.
The Marx Brothers. No?
You're close. Sort of like the British Marx Brothers.
Monty Python?
Yeah, and the Holy Grail. Very nice.
Ding. Give us another category.
Okay, yeah, given a city, you have to say what TV show was set in this fictional city. For example, Bedrock.
Flintstones.
Very good. Cabot Cove, Maine.
Something with Stephen King? Cabot Cove, Maine.
You're close. It's a mystery show.
Oh, Angela Lansbury?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Murder, She Wrote. Very nice. Sicily, Alaska.
Oh, that one with the radio host.
Very
and they
good.
Were all, what was it called?
Northern Exposure.
Northern Exposure, right.
See, I'm much more helpful than Alex Trebek.
He
would be like, oh, no, no, I need the actual title, Robin. I'm sorry.
Ken Jennings, what's your life like now? I mean, you're recognizable. Do people walk up to you and say, I'm going to stump you? I mean, is it...
It does happen sometimes, actually. I was in the grocery store the other day, and the guy, you know, the produce guy, he's misting the eggplant or something. And he looks up and sees me, and he says, ah, it's you. What's another name for solid-leafed parsley? He asks me produce trivia, and I assume it's because he recognized me. I hope he doesn't do this to everybody, or that's a very odd supermarket.
What is another name for...
According to this guy, cilantro.
Of course, yes.
I don't know.
Yes, I would have gotten that.
See, we need you for the grocery store trivia.
Well, Ken, we just want to thank you also because we understand that of your winnings, you tithed to your church.
I did.
And also gave some to NPR.
I'm a big fan of public TV, public radio. I always feel guilty during the pledge drives if I don't give. So
we'll take it now.
It's nice to be able to write a nice check now and not feel guilty.
Okay, we'll just take care of that. Ken Jennings, the greatest champion in Jeopardy history, the author of the new book, Ken Jennings Trivia Almanac, 8,888 questions in 365 days. Thank you so much.
Hey, thanks a lot, Robin.
All good things have to come to an end, don't they? Well, too bad for Ken, but he's going home with a lot of money. $2.5 million. Congratulations, young man.